We continue in The Ascent of the Sacrifice, Part 2, The Works of Love, The Works of Life. This is the sixth chapter in the first part of the synthesis of yoga, called the Yoga of Divine Works. Sri Aurobindo, when we put our bookmarks last time, was describing the action of the Mahashakti as we ascend into communion with her and as the force and power of the divine consciousness descends from above into our actual life. So that it is a higher nature that assumes dynamic control of the lower. So what is here sattva becomes jyoti. What is here rajas becomes tapas. What is here tamas becomes shama. So light, power, calm, descend and transfix themselves into the entirety of the human vehicle. Matter, life, and mind. So now, Sri Aurobindo will describe what this means in a more intimate working. He reads, in this process, and at an early stage of it, it becomes evident that what we know of ourselves, our present conscious existence, is only a representative formation, a superficial activity, a changing external result of a vast mass of concealed existence. So here he's referring to the being that we know is commonly the outer being. And there's an enormous ocean at work. Us, the universe, throwing out this formation, which we take to be ourselves. Our visible life and the actions of that life are no more than a series of significant expressions, but that which it tries to express is not on the surface. Our existence is something much larger than this apparent frontal being which we suppose ourselves to be and which we offer to the world around us. So this reverses the portrayal of what is our self as it appears to be in nature and suggests that there is something deep within that wants to express itself and which occasionally reaches the surface but often clouded. This frontal and external being is a confused amalgam of mind formations, life movements, physical functionings, of which even an exhaustive analysis into its component parts and machinery fails to reveal the whole secret. It is only when we go behind, below, above, into the hidden stretches of our being that we can know it. The most thorough and acute surface scrutiny and manipulation cannot give us the true understanding or the completely effective control of our life, its purposes, its activities. That inability, indeed, is the cause of the failure of reason, morality, and every other surface action to control and deliver and perfect the life of the human race. So here he suggests that there is an omnipresent reality. There is an environmental consciousness. There is much for us to come to know. And so now he gives a rapid depiction of what is the map of consciousness. For below, even our most obscure physical consciousness is a subconscious being in which, as in a covering and supporting soil, are all manner of hidden seeds that sprout up unaccountably to us, on our surface, and into which we are constantly throwing fresh seeds that prolong our past and will influence our future. A subconscious being, obscure, small in its motions, capriciously and almost fantastically sub-rational, but of an immense potency for the earth life. Again, behind our mind, our life, our conscious physical, there is a larger subliminal consciousness. There are inner mental, inner vital, inner more subtle physical reaches supported by an inmost psychic existence, which is the animating soul of all the rest. And in these hidden reaches, too, lie a mass of numerous pre-existent personalities, which supply the material, the motive forces, the impulsions of our developing surface existence. Now remember, he's writing here in 1932, and this won't see the beginning of publication, even in journal form, until 1946. But he's setting out what is a map of our being, and which is coincident with the cosmic being. There is nothing in us that doesn't exist in the universe, and there's nothing in the universe that doesn't exist in us. The macrocosm and the microcosm mirror each other, the large and the small. So below, at the base, you might say, doesn't list it here, but is an inconscient being. It is the reverse of the superconscient being, but buried, its self-awareness completely submerged, and then rising out of that is a subconscious nature. Rising out of that is the physical nature. Poised above the physical is the vital nature. Above the vital is the mental. And then, reaching the apex of mentality, we hit that golden lid which divides the lower world, the triple lower world of matter, life, mind, from the radiant regions of the sublime suprarational being. That is where supermind begins and all the range of Satchit Ananda above. So this is the great chain of being. He's given a quick depiction here. But not simply are there these layers of existence, but we can come to know them inwardly, because the subliminal existence behind the line is what it means. There is a gate, in a sense, a wall in front of us that seemingly divides our personality from the rest of the world. So we think of it as being other. Just so, there is a deep interior dimension of our being, which we don't know either. We get glimpses of it. It leans into us, sometimes with more power than at other times, luminously, obscurely. But behind the gate of our desire being and our ego structure lies an interior mind, a subliminal mind, an inner vital, and a subtle physical consciousness. All of these really extrude themselves coagently into what we call the surface being. At the core of all of this subliminal action, inner mind, inner vital, and subtle physical, is an actuating soul spark that has grown through repeated experiences in the world, from its immortal nature into and out of being a spark into being a flame. This is the psychic being. This is what really sustains and gives coherence to all the machinery of our external nature, but we know it not. And this is the point that he's reaching here to describe that we have this inner soul. And he says, there are a mass of pre-existent personalities. Now, this is very interesting because this doesn't come out at once. Multitude of subordinate personalities. Roberto Assagioli, the great Italian psychologist, the founder of the psychosynthesis school, used this as a pivotal insight to show people that they could gain access to their secret regions by discovering what are these subordinate personalities, or as he called them, sub-personalities, to see how they acted, how they interacted, how they could be malformed in their presentation. And if we can develop an insightful conversation with them, we can discover the best way to free them from enchainment to ignorance and to come into efflorescence expression in our actual lives. And thus, we can begin to integrate our being, which is also Sri Aurobindo's goal. But Sri Aurobindo sees it in more of a cosmic and enlarged context than even Assagioli was able to ascertain. So there, well, let's read. Let me read that starting from here. For in each one of us, here, there may be one central person, but also a multitude of subordinate personalities created by the past history of its manifestation or by expressions of it on these inner planes which support its present play in this external material cosmos. And while on our surface we are cut off from all around us except through an exterior mind and sense contact, which delivers but little of us to our world or of our world to us, in these inner reaches, the barrier between us and the rest of existence is thin and easily broken. There we can feel at once, not merely infer from their results, but feel directly the action of the secret world forces, mind forces, life forces, subtle physical forces that constitute universal and individual existence. We shall even be able, if we will but train ourselves to it, to lay our hands on these world forces that throw themselves on us or surround us, and more, to control, or at least strongly modify their action on us and others, their formations, their very movements. So he's saying that once inside, when we have poised ourselves in our inner being, then knowledge and power grow. And this is part of the aim of the yogic life. And as he says here, we can modify the world's action upon us and on others because there is always a social context as well that Sri Aurobindo has in his view. How can the yogin benefit humanity? How can he benefit the larger corporate body? Because even if you're not working for all of humanity, you can work for those who are part of your kula, part of your family, part of your spiritual lineage, etc. Those in your immediate neighborhood, those in your village, in your city, etc. You can benefit all with the light that grows within you. So if you find that inner poise, gain insight, and gain force, you can lean back into the world with it, pour it into active streams, and help to change life. So he moves on. Yet again, above our human mind are still greater reaches, superconscient to it, and from there secretly descend influences, powers, touches, which are the original determinants of things here, and if they were called down in their fullness, could altogether alter the whole make and economy of life in the material universe. So if he's described the subconscious and called our attention to the subliminal reaches of nature, now he points above to the superconscient, where, in fact, this world stems from. Its roots are above. Its branches extend below. So when you get back to the higher consciousness, you're getting home. You really are going back to the origin of all things. And those powers, influences, can reach down, touch us, influence, merge with us. And if we can bring them down, as he says, in their fullness, the word which translated into Sanskrit is siddhi, fulfillment, could altogether alter the whole make and economy of life in the material universe. Now, he's not talking here about the exchange of money. He means economy in the Greek sense, economia, which means the law of the house. Oikos means house. So the eco is where we live. This is our habitation. Why would you not bring to utter perfection the house in which you live? And you live first in your inner being, and then you live in your body, and then you live in your home, and then you live in your social group, etc., etc. And the circle gets enlarged and enlarged and enlarged more. He continues, it is all this latent experience and knowledge that the divine force working upon us by our opening to it in the integral yoga progressively reveals to us, uses, and works out the consequences as means and steps towards a transformation of our whole being and nature. Remember, for Sri Aurobindo, this is not a yoga about liberating our inner being, psychologically becoming free, but rather a transformation of life as it is. Yes, a full transformation of life, nothing short of that, a radical means getting back to the root of things, a radical transformation. Where's the root? Above. To bring that here, to marry spirit to matter, is the whole endeavor. So he says here, the divine force, again, another word for the yoga shakti, who opens and guides the surrendering soul to fulfillment. It is pinned on the aspiration, which stirs in us the motivation to surrender, to give ourselves, to offer our whole being, a complete consecration, a making sacred of our entire nature. And that is what permits her, gives her visible, tangible permission to descend. And then she comes. Our life is thenceforth no longer a little rolling wave on the surface, but interpenetrant, if not coincident, with the cosmic life. We merge back into the larger universe. Our spirit, our self, rises not only into an inner identity with some wide cosmic self, but into some contact with that which is beyond, though aware of and dominant over the action of the universe. So yes, our soul is the small universe. The large universe we come into living communion with as we grow yogically. But we must rise beyond to the transcendence from which both cosmos and individual hail. So, the way he describes this too is a being who is dominant over the action of the universe. So there is a conscious power to whom we offer. Not a raw impersonality, not an abstract absolute, but a conscious being who watches, invites, and waits for us to respond. Because really, our ascent in the sacrifice that he describes here, is guided intimately and ultimately by that. It is thus by an integralization, and that means making one, it is thus by an integralization of our divided being that the divine Shakti in the yoga will proceed to its object. For liberation, perfection, mastery are dependent on this integralization, since the little wave on the surface cannot control its own movement, much less have any true control over the vast life around it. So you can see here, liberation is combined with perfection and mastery. Liberation, not simply freedom from the false identity with ego, but this is a wholesale liberation too, where not only mind and life are awakened, but body too is awakened and enlivened, really enlivened, by the soul force from behind and within. The Shakti, the power of the infinite and the eternal, descends within us, works, breaks up our present psychological formations, shatters every wall, widens, liberates, presents us with always newer and greater powers of vision, ideation, perception, and newer and greater life motives, enlarges and new models increasingly, the soul and its instruments, confronts us with every imperfection in order to convict and destroy it, opens to a greater perfection, does, in a brief period, the work of many lives or ages, so that new births and new vistas open constantly within us. What a sentence. She starts within and challenges the obscurity personally and cosmically with her light and force. The work of many lives or ages. This reminds one of the phrase from the Rig Veda, the endless dawns that are described, the rolling succession of dawns. Expansive interaction. She frees the consciousness from confinement in the body. It can go out in trance or sleep or even waking and enter into worlds or other regions of this world and act there or carry back its experience. This describes the action of Agni as he courses through the world, seeking the element to be offered, giving, transporting, carrying it himself, and then coming back with the fruit that descends from the gift delivered there. There is a response. It spreads out, feeling the body only as a small part of itself, and begins to contain what before contained it. It achieves the cosmic consciousness and extends itself to be commensurate with the universe. Yes, we experience ourselves as being this little consciousness locked inside a body. But when we really experience what we are, we see that the body floats in our larger being. Our vitality greatly extends beyond the expanse of this little body. Our mental being far beyond that. Our spiritual being. There is no line that demarcates us from anything. We are one with the universe. We stretch beyond the universe into the timeless and unmanifest reality that ever is free from all that happens here and yet sustains all that happens here. All this we are. It begins to know inwardly and directly, and not merely by external observation and contact. The forces at play in the world feels their movement, distinguishes their functioning, and can operate immediately upon them as the scientist operates upon physical forces, accept their action and results in our mind, life, body, or reject them, or modify, change, reshape, create immense new powers and movements in place of the old small functionings of the nature. So we saw a few sentences above, him describing what our inner being experiences in true psychological dimension. And here he's describing what dynamism we can achieve as we enter into active concert with the forces inside. And how does he say we do this? By becoming one in knowledge. We begin to know inwardly and directly. Remember that for Sri Aurobindo, the height, the truth of epistemology. We know something when we become one with it. When we become one with it, then we can direct its power. All through here, Sri Aurobindo describes what he did back in the teens of the century as he was discovering the inner enginery and putting his hands on that equipment and forcing upon the body, upon the inner vital, upon the mental being, changes that he insisted must be there in answer to the demand, the fiat, the adesh of the divine consciousness above. So he was actively in using this body, life, mind complex as a laboratory in which he worked out new powers, new ways of being, which is how he broke free ultimately and arrived at the overmental realization on the 24th of November in 1926. We'll come to that. So he's described our inner feeling and dynamism. Now, we begin to perceive the working of the forces of universal mind and to know how our thoughts are created by that working, separate from within the truth and falsehood of our perceptions, separate from within the truth and falsehood of our perceptions, enlarge their field, extend and illumine their significance, become master of our own minds, and active to shape the movements of mind in the world around us. So it's through an intimate knowledge of ourself that we come to know what our soul is, an identification that we come to harness the powers secret in the universe, active but not known to us, and so secret, and now a full disclosure to the mind as it becomes aware. It becomes full of light. It knows. We begin to perceive the flow and surge of the universal life forces, detect the origin and law of our feelings, emotions, sensations, passions, are free to accept, reject, new create, open to wider, rise to higher planes of life power. We begin to perceive, too, the key to the enigma of matter. Follow the interplay of mind and life and consciousness upon it. Discover more and more its instrumental and resultant function and detect, ultimately, the last secret of matter as a form, not merely of energy, but of involved and arrested or unstably fixed in restricted consciousness, and begin to see, too, the possibility of its liberation and plasticity of response to higher powers, its possibilities for the conscious and no longer the more than half-inconscient incarnation and self-expression of the spirit. So the mystery of matter is the secret springs of conscious being, which we can come to know. So he's gone one large step beyond Einstein, who equated matter and energy. Sri Aurobindo says, no, both are prepollent expressions of conscious power, chit shakti. All this and more becomes more and more possible as the working of the divine Shakti increases in us, and against much resistance or labor, to respond to our obscure consciousness through much struggle and movement of progress and regression and renewed progress necessitated by the work of intensive transformation of a half-inconscient into a conscious substance moves to a greater purity, truth, height, range. All depends on the psychic awakening in us, the completeness of our response to her, and our growing surrender. So this goes to his book, The Mother, that small gem with which he launched the Sri Aurobindo Ashram and gave it its first direction. This would be in chapter 1. There must be a total and sincere surrender. There must be an exclusive self-opening to the divine power. There must be a constant and integral choice of the truth that is descending, a constant and integral rejection of the falsehood of the mental, vital, and physical powers and appearances that still rule the earth nature. The surrender must be total and seize all the parts of the being. It is not enough that the psychic should respond and the higher mental accept or even the inner vital submit and the inner physical consciousness feel the influence. There must be in no part of the being, even the most external, anything that makes a reserve, anything that hides behind doubts, confusions, and subterfuges, anything that revolts or refuses. So you see, Sri Aurobindo is continuing the same line of active insight, taking, as he established it in the book, The Mother, and fashion it into the actual articles of what are the principles of the integral yoga here in these chapters. So if we didn't get it in the little book, The Mother, perhaps we'll get it when we read this. But all this can only constitute a greater inner life with a greater possibility of the outer action and is a transitional achievement. The full transformation can come only by the ascent of the sacrifice to its farthest heights and its action upon life with the power and light and beatitude of the divine supramental gnosis. So we have actually to leave the belt of the known universe, in a sense, matter, life, mind, and ascend to this Gnostic consciousness, which is full of light and power, which is above, in a sense, which has seated itself and concealed itself in this universe. We need that power above, active in us, to strike at the roots of where it hides at the base of the universe and awaken it. For then alone, he writes, all the forces that are divided and express themselves imperfectly in life and its works are raised to their original unity, harmony, single truth, authentic absoluteness, and entire significance. There, knowledge and will are one, love and force, a single movement. The opposites that afflict us here are resolved into their reconciled unity. Good develops its absolute, and evil, divesting itself of its error, returns to the good that was behind it. Sin and virtue vanish in a divine purity and an infallible truth movement. The dubious evanescence of pleasure disappears in a bliss that is the play of an eternal and happy spiritual certitude, and pain in perishing discovers the touch of an ananda, which was betrayed by some dark perversion and incapacity of the will of the inconscient to receive it. So we have come back to Satchit-Ananda through the power of this Gnostic consciousness. These things, to the mind and imagination, or a mystery, become evident and capable of experience as the consciousness rises out of limited embodied matter-mind to the freedom and fullness of the higher and higher ranges of the superintelligence. But they can become entirely true and normal only when the supramental becomes the law of nature. It is therefore on the accomplishments of this ascent and on the possibility of a full dynamism from these highest levels descending into earth consciousness that is dependent the justification of life, its salvation, its transformation into a divine life in a transfigured terrestrial nature. So this describes Agni, the leader of the march, as he climbs this mystic fire upwards with the offering of the soul and all its experiences into the sunlight, into the radiance of the sun, into Surya itself, and then returns with its rays. Agni, the mystic fire, the immortalized soul, revivified, empowered with its original force, returns with these rays into the waiting earth nature, Prithvi, and divinizes it. So this Vedic passage that Sri Aurobindo has alluded to in both these last two chapters, the ascent of the sacrifice, has that as its goal, and that is its response from the divine. It comes. It agrees to descend. And it claims the earth. And what does it do? It justifies, it saves, it transforms. This is very like mysticism that you find all over the world. But if you remember the Parsifal legend, you know, he, in a sense, becomes emblematic of how the Redeemer is redeemed. Go and read that myth, that legend. Listen to that opera by Wagner at his finest. So just a couple of more pages. The nature of the integral yoga, so conceived, so conditioned, progressing by these spiritual means, turning upon this integral transformation of the nature, determines of itself its answer to the question of the ordinary activities of life and their place in the yoga. There is not and cannot be here any ascetic or contemplative or mystic abandonment of works and life altogether, any gospel of an absorbed meditation and inactivity, any cutting away or condemnation of the life force and its activities, any rejection of the manifestation in the earth nature. So this is a spirituality that does not repudiate nature, but accepts, affirms, and uplifts. It declines asceticism and morality and reclusion from the world. It may be necessary for the seeker at any period to withdraw into himself, to remain plunged in his inner being, to shut out from him the noise and turmoil of the life of the ignorance until a certain inner change has been accomplished or something achieved without which a further effective action on life has become difficult or impossible. So as he demonstrated in his own life, there could be a period of withdrawal, but a coming back in, an establishment of an ashram, a coordinating of a collective life aimed towards transformation. But this can only be a period or an episode, a temporary necessity or a preparatory spiritual maneuver. It cannot be the rule of his yoga or its principle. And Sri Aurobindo was consistent too in letters that he began writing around this period. Remember how his letters overwashed all of his activities? His correspondence, in a sense, displaced his coming back to the whole of the synthesis and recasting it and enlarging it. So in those letters, occasionally the question was asked, may I hie away into profound meditation? I won't be seen for some months. And he would say, no. Some short period of time necessary to engross yourself in that spiritual condition, but then come back out and learn to be active without losing the spiritual condition. A splitting up of the activities of human existence on a religious or an ethical basis, or both together, a restriction to the works of worship only, or to the works of philanthropy and beneficence only, would be contrary to the spirit of the integral yoga. Any merely mental rule or merely mental acceptance or repudiation is alien to the purpose and method of its discipline. So he alludes here to the next chapter, which we'll take up next week, Standards of Conduct, Spiritual Freedom. All must be taken to a spiritual height and placed upon a spiritual basis. The presence of an inner spiritual change and an outer transformation must be enforced upon the whole of life and not merely on a part of life. All must be accepted that is helpful towards this change or admits it. All must be rejected that is incapable or inapt or refuses to submit itself to the transforming movement. Again, the book, The Mother. There must be no attachment to any form of things or of life, any object, any activity. All must be renounced if need be. All must be admitted that the divine chooses as its material for the divine life. But what accepts or rejects must be neither mind nor open or camouflaged vital will of desire nor ethical sense, but the insistence of the psychic being, the command of the divine guide of the yoga, the vision of the higher self or spirit, the illumined guidance of the master. The way of the spirit is not a mental way. A mental rule or mental consciousness cannot be its determinant or its leader. And we know the leader of the march is the psychic being in the Veda known as Agni, the Devata. Equally, a combination or a compromise between two orders of consciousness, the spiritual and the mental, or the spiritual and the vital, or a mere sublimation from within of life outwardly unchanged, cannot be the law or the aim of the yoga. All life must be taken up, but all life must be transformed. All must become a part of form and adequate expression of a spiritual being in the supramental nature. So he's still got his vision locked on the farthest reaches of what is the transformative process. And if all life is yoga, here's the corollary. All life must be taken off, but all life must be transformed. He accepts life, but not as it is. Accepts life in order to transform it. This is the height and crowning movement of a spiritual evolution in the material world. And as the change from the vital animal to mental man made life another thing altogether in basic consciousness, scope, significance, so this change from the materialized mental being to the spiritual and supramental being, using but not dominated by matter, must take up life and make it another thing altogether than the flawed, imperfect, limited human, quite other in its basic consciousness, scope, significance. All forms of life activity that cannot bear the change must disappear. All that can bear it will survive and enter into the kingdom of the Spirit. A divine force is at work and will choose at each moment what has to be done or has not to be done, what has to be momentarily or permanently taken up, momentarily or permanently abandoned. For provided we do not substitute for that our desire or our ego. And to that end, the soul must be always awake, always on guard, alive to the divine guidance, resistant to the undivine misleading from within or without us. That force is sufficient and alone competent, and she will lead us to the fulfillment along ways and by means too large, too inward, too complex for the mind to follow, much less to dictate. It is an arduous and difficult and dangerous way, but there is none other. Fulfillment in Sanskrit, siddhi. And this is chapter 2 in the Mother. I wonder if I can find... In proportion as the surrender and self-consecration progress, the sadhaka becomes conscious of the divine Shakti doing the sadhana, pouring into him more and more of herself, founding in him the freedom and perfection of the divine nature. The more this conscious process replaces his own effort, the more rapid and true becomes his progress. But it cannot completely replace the necessity of personal effort until the surrender and consecration are pure and complete from top to bottom. Two rules alone there are that will diminish the difficulty and obviate the danger. One must reject all that comes from the ego, from vital desire, from the mere mind and its presumptuous reasoning incompetence, all that ministers to these agents of the ignorance. One must learn to hear and follow the voice of the inmost soul, the direction of the guru, the command of the master, the working of the divine mother. Whoever clings to the desires and weaknesses of the flesh, the cravings and passions of the vital in its turbulent ignorance, the dictates of his personal mind, unsilenced and unillumined by a greater knowledge, cannot find the true inner law and is heaping obstacles in the way of the divine fulfillment. Whoever is able to detect and renounce those obscuring agencies and to discern and follow the true guide within and without will discover the spiritual law and reach the goal of the yoga. So one, the power of rejection, and the second, receptivity based on our recognition through discrimination, viveka, the voice of the soul. A radical and total change of consciousness is not only the whole meaning, but in an increasing force and by progressive stages, the whole method of the integral yoga. So it is an inner process that seizes matter, life, and mind and effectuates this. Radical, getting back to the root, total change of consciousness. So we have to live from inside out. So that completes our chapter, The Ascent of the Sacrifice. And next week, we'll look up into the heights of the standards of conduct and spiritual freedom. But for now, we turn again to Savitri. This is in the Book of Beginnings, Book 1, Canto 5, The Yoga of the Spirit's Freedom and Greatness. Ironically, in our daily reading, this is the passage we read yesterday, and I think it's apt for tonight. In a divine retreat from mortal thought, in a prodigious gesture of soul sight, his being towered into pathless heights, naked of its vesture of humanity. As thus it rose, to meet him bare and pure, a strong descent leaped down, a might, a flame, a beauty half visible with deathless eyes, a violent ecstasy, a sweetness dire, enveloped him with its stupendous limbs and penetrated nerve and heart and brain that thrilled and fainted with the epiphany. His nature shuddered in the unknown's grasp. In a moment shorter than death, longer than time. By a power more ruthless than love, happier than heaven, taken sovereignly into eternal arms, hailed and coerced by a stark absolute bliss, in a whirlwind circuit of delight and force, hurried into unimaginable depths, upborne into immeasurable heights, it was torn out from its mortality and underwent a new and bornless change. An omniscient knowing without sight or thought, an indecipherable omnipotence, a mystic form that could contain the worlds, yet make one human breast its passionate shrine, drew him out of his seeking loneliness into the magnitudes of God's embrace. As when a timeless eye annuls the hours, abolishing the agent and the act, so now his spirit shone out wide, blank, pure. His wakened mind became an empty slate on which the universal and soul could write. All that represses our fallen consciousness was taken from him like a forgotten load. A fire that seemed the body of a god consumed the limiting figures of the past and made large room for a new self to live. Eternity's contact broke the molds of sense. A greater force than the earthly held his limbs. Huge workings bared his undiscovered sheaths. Strange energies wrought, and screened tremendous hands unwound the triple cord of mind and freed the heavenly wideness of a Godhead's gaze. As through a dress the wearer's shape is seen, there reached through forms to the hidden absolute a cosmic feeling and transcendent sight. Increased and heightened were the instruments. Illusion lost her aggrandizing lens. As from her failing hand the measures fell, atomic looked the things that loomed so large. The little ego's ring could join no more. In the enormous spaces of the self, the body now seemed only a wandering shell, his mind the many-frescoed outer court of an imperishable inhabitant. His spirit breathed a superhuman air. Namaste. Jai Ma.